From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Alan Arkin tells us he had a surprisingly hard time learning to play comedies. Arkin's movies include The Russians Are Coming, Catch-22, and Joshua Then and Now. Also today, psychiatrist Irvin Yalom opens up his casebook for us and discusses the patient-therapist relationship. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from Janet Jackson and Laurie Anderson. And guest film critic Peter Rayner reviews the new movie Drugstore Cowboy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Four politicians in East Germany resigned today, buckling under to growing pressure for reform in that country. Deidre Berger reports from Cologne.
The most spectacular resignation today was that of union boss Harry Tisch. The party-run union is the largest organization in East Germany. Tisch tried to save his job earlier this week, but finally capitulated after local unions reported threats of mass resignations. The East German government today also confirmed the resignation of Education Minister Margot Honecker. The wife of former leader Erich Honecker was an unpopular figure in the government. Despite growing pressure for dynamic reformers, the women selected as replacements for the union chief and the education minister are considered party faithful. The heads of two of the four parties in the government coalition also stepped down today. Further personnel changes are expected next week. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
El Salvador's leftist rebels today announced they are withdrawing from peace talks with the government until protection can be guaranteed for opposition unions. In a statement read over local radio, the rebels said they will hold government and army responsible for the bombing deaths of 10 people at a leftist labor union on Tuesday. In Nicaragua, Sandinista troops launched attacks against Contra forces, which have infiltrated the nation's central and northern provinces. The Contras announced today they've accepted in principle a Sandinista offer to meet Monday and Tuesday at the United Nations to discuss demobilization. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said it is unrealistic to expect the Contras to lay down their arms while the Sandinista government is, quote, out to destroy them. The third day of hearings on the crash of United Airlines Flight 232 in Sioux City, Iowa, focused on FAA regulations for airline manufacturers. Doug Johnson of member station KWIT reports.
A fault in the forward fan disc continues to draw the attention of the technical panel. It is the disintegration of that part that some investigators feel caused the explosion which led to a massive hydraulic system failure. A fan containment ring is supposed to keep loose pieces from leaving the inside of the engine in the event of a mechanical failure. FAA spokesman Jay Pardee said that there are no regulations that require the fan containment ring to withhold the force of a fan disc coming apart.
I think at the energy levels of rotating components, certainly massive discs, it's essentially impractical with the present state of the art to contain such a high energy rotor.
The hearings are scheduled to address infant seating issues on Friday. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Johnson in Sioux City, Iowa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 14 points to close at 26,31.56. Declines led advances 3-2. This is NPR News. President Bush and Senate Republicans offered today to end their attempts to attach a capital gains tax cut to crucial debt legislation. The action is seen as a defeat for Bush on the administration's top legislative priority. Congress would have to increase the national debt limit next week to stave off a default by the Treasury. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole told Democrats that Republicans would agree to limit amendments to the debt ceiling legislation to those repealing a Medicare tax to finance catastrophic illness and a tax provision opposed by business. 1 week after a two-day riot hit the Camp Hill State Prison in south-central Pennsylvania, there's been a shakeup in the State Corrections Department. Maria Gabriel of member station WITF reports.
State Corrections Commissioner David Owens announced late Wednesday that he has suspended the superintendent of the Camp Hill Prison. In a three-paragraph statement, Owens said Robert Freeman will be on suspension without pay indefinitely. The statement goes on to say that Freeman will remain off the job pending the outcome of a probe by a governor's commission investigating the riot. Owen says he took the action based on information he received late yesterday. However, he would not disclose the information. The three-member commission investigating the riot is expected to have its report on the governor's desk by December 1st. More than 100 people were hurt in the two-day uprising last week, which left the institution badly damaged. For National Public Radio, I'm Maria Gabriel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Congressional Democrats today asked the Justice Department to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce. They say House investigators have turned up volumes of evidence to suggest possible perjury and conspiracy to defraud the government by Pierce. One of Pierce's lawyers, Robert Plotkin, criticized the action and said it would delay further any congressional testimony by Pierce. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Arkin, starred in the films The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Catch-22, The 7% Solution, The In-Laws, and Joshua Then and Now. As a director, he did the stage and screen versions of Jules Feiffer's Little Murders. Arkin recently directed an episode of Public TV's anthology comedy series Trying Times. It stars Gene Stapleton and Corey Feldman as two discontented people working at a fast food restaurant. The episode is called The Boss, and it will be shown in mid-November. Arkin also will co-star in a new film, Coup de Ville, which is scheduled to be released in March. Alan Arkin told me why he likes to work in different media.
I keep thinking that when I change media, something new and wonderful is going to happen, and I'm going to break through the limits of my own personality, and it never seems to happen. I look at my writing, and I see the same kind of things I like about my acting and the same kind of things I dislike about my acting, and I feel like my direction has the same assets and liabilities as everything else I do.
Has that been one of the difficult things about performing, learning to figure out and then to accept what your limitations are?
Yeah, I never realized that until recently, but I think that, well, for me, one of the goals is to be something more than what I am, and no matter how far afield I think I'm going, in retrospect, I look back and all I see is me, even no matter how many hats I change, no matter how many limps I affect or speech patterns I change, I almost invariably only see me. There have been a couple of times when I feel like I've transcended my own identity, and those were really enormously exciting times for me.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with seeing yourself in a role, though?
That's not the idea of doing it. I think originally that is people. I guess people want to perform initially because they want to be seen. Hey, look at me! Look what I'm doing! But then once in a while you reach something. I've been lecturing on this for the past year or two, on this very idea. You reach something in, and it's not just performing, it's almost any field, which is a kind of a epiphany where you're no longer there. And I achieved that for the first time when I was about 19 or 20, and when I had been studying acting fervently. And I wasn't on stage for about 20 minutes. I disappeared. And it's as if I was watching myself play the character, and it was the most exhilarating thing I'd ever experienced up until that time. And for the next 20 years or so, I became a junkie to that experience. Athletes have that experience. They have a term for it now. It's called being in the zone. When they do things they can't do, when they run faster than they can run, when they're impossible to catch on a football field, when they can hit a ball faster and harder than they've ever been done before in tennis. And it comes from really honing down your craft and letting yourself completely go. And then this thing takes over. And once you've experienced that, nothing else will satisfy you anymore. And once you've had that feeling, you can see in looking back at it that you've had this feeling. I mean, like in the performances that I've done where I've been, in quotes, in the zone, I can see that. I can see that I've literally disappeared and the character is there playing me. And once having had that feeling, you don't settle for anything else anymore.
Do you think that the impulse to act comes in part from wanting to get out of yourself, transcend yourself?
Oh, yeah, I think for a lot of people. I don't think they phrase it that poetically initially. I think a lot of times comes out of a kind of self-loathing that a lot of people aren't really aware of at the time, wanting to be any, it certainly was in me, and I see it in the work of a lot of other people too, a desire to be anybody else but who you are. It also can come out of a kind of a childish thing of imitating other people, wanting to be, you know, seeing your father and imitating him, seeing other people around that look interesting, as if they have interesting attributes you want to adopt and affect. It's, I think that's another way of.
Well, who are those people around you who you who had mannerisms that you adapted when you were young and really impressionable?
It was endless. I used to imitate people on the street. I used to imitate actors that I saw. I used to imitate family members. I used to watch people's behavior in terms of how affected I was from an acting standpoint. So real life became fodder for acting for me, which I think helped my acting, but didn't do my life any good.
So even Thanksgiving dinner was, you'd be there watching how everybody was behaving?
Yeah, how did this person eat? Why am I moved when somebody says something in that way? And why can somebody else say almost the same thing and I'm not moved by them? It doesn't affect me. I was really caught up in that from a very early age on, from the age of 6, 7, 8.
Alan Arkin is my guest, and you could see a new episode of Trying Times that he directed. The episode's called The Boss, and it will be on in mid-November on public television. When you were growing up, was there anyone in your family or in your neighborhood who was theatrical in the way they lived their life? I don't mean that they were necessarily on the stage, but they had this sense of the theater of life.
Yeah, oh, very much so. There was a guy named Sam Kennedy, who was the husband of my mother's best friend, who was the most flamboyant character I'd ever met. He was right out of Sean O'Casey. And he wore black turtleneck sweaters, woolen ones, without any underwear underneath, and jeans in days when nobody was doing things like that, in the 40s and late 30s. And he was about 6'4" and had a mustache and was a merchant seaman and a sculptor and a guitarist and drank like a fish. And he was the most flamboyant person I think I'd ever met. And
you like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was very organic. There was nothing artificial about it. It came right from the heart of him.
And any really colorful speakers?
Speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, him, my father was always very good verbally, and my grandfather was made speeches for the Masons, so he was very literate. I have a vivid memory of him reading a speech, tears streaming down his face, to a plumber who was, the two of them were in the bathroom, and the plumber, all you could see was his feet sticking out from under the bathtub. He was paying absolutely no attention to my grandfather. And there he was reading this passionate speech with tears streaming down his face.
So here you were with all of this interest in theater. And when you got, I think it was when you got out of college in around 1956, you were part of the pop folk group, The Terriers.
Yeah.
And they had a hit that made it onto the charts, actually, of the Banana Boat song and what, Cindy O' Cindy?
Yeah.
It seems, it almost seems like you were miscast in that group.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I felt so myself. I ended up after about 2 years being on stage at the Olympia Theater in Paris to an audience of about 3,000. We were singing our hearts out, and I looked down at myself, and there I was in black satin pants and a sport shirt open to my navel practically. And I said, "Who am I? What am I doing here?" And I quit that night and went back to what I wanted to do, which was be connected with film and theater.
How did you get into the detour of folk music to begin with?
Well, I had gotten out of college, and I had gotten married and had a small child at the age of 22, and I needed something to do to just get us going. And there was this group that started, and I thought it would only take up my weekends periodically, and we'd make a little spare change to just survive on it. And within 3 months, we had an enormous hit on our hands, and so we traveled around the world with that for about 2 years, and it just seemed to me that it was the logical thing to do at the time. And I also thought, in my naive fashion, that would be an entree into film and theater, which it wasn't.
Well, yeah. I think one of your entrees into film and theater was Chicago's Second
City
group.
Yeah, it was my entree into everything.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I got born there.
Second City was an improvisational theater and comedy group. Were you surprised that you were good at improvisation?
Very, yeah. I had no idea I had any abilities in that area at all. In fact, it took me months to be funny. I would work out with David Shepard in the group, and I wasn't funny. Nothing I did was funny. And then finally I hit upon one character that was funny. So I just played that character for a long time. No matter what I did as that character, people laughed. And so I said, well, I'll stick with that.
What was the character?
I don't remember. It was one ethnic type or another. I don't remember exactly who it was. But then I started adding to that character. I started adding other characters to that character. And I ended up with a library of characters that I played, that each of which I felt were very far from what I was as a person, only to find out 10 years later and looking back that they were all exactly like me, every one of them.
Who were some of the characters?
Well, I had a Puerto Rican kid, a sensitive Puerto Rican kid who considered himself unable to do anything in society, played guitar. I had an ancient Jewish pretzel vendor who was modeled after my grandfather. I had an Italian laborer. I had a Chinese chef. That was the first four, I think. But I tried to use them in everything. I tried to squeeze them in every conceivable kind of place because they were the only things I felt comfortable with for a long time.
So at what point were you ready to like leave those characters aside and play comedy yourself?
Well, it was a long time. It really started when Mike Nichols cast me as Yossarian in Catch 22, and I kept looking at the character and looking at it, and I said, well, I finally asked him, who do I play him like? Who is he? Who should I model him after? He said, he's you. Mike said, he's you. And I thought to myself, what does he mean, me? There isn't any me. There's going to be a blank on the screen if I just do me. Nobody will show up. And he finally convinced me that I just had to be myself in that situation, and I had great trepidation about it. I didn't know how to do that. But I tried it, and I went to the dailies for a week or two with a lot of anxiety, thinking that there was going to be a blank hole in the screen where I was, and to my surprise and finally I had to admit delight, there was somebody there. And I said, hey, there is a me. And I guess in most ways, that was a real transition for me, and seeing that I had an existence, that I did have some weight as myself, and that I could afford to let go of those a lot of the places that I was hiding under.
Well, let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. And my guest is actor and director Alan Arkin. He's starred in The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, Catch 22, The 7% Solution, Joshua Then and Now, and many other films. And he directed an upcoming episode of the public television comedy series Trying Times. It will be broadcast in mid-November, and it stars Gene Stapleton. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Alan Arkin is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your first feature film, The Russians Are Coming. Earlier you said that when you looked back on this role, you didn't feel like you saw yourself, you saw the character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All to keep him calm, please. Yes. I repeat, no harm is coming. Olga, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey. Just take it easy now, Pete, boy. Don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions very quickly, please, so that there is no necessity whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
So that there is no necessity whatsoever why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken. because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was a big, it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds, and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set, and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly, and there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin, let's jump ahead to 1985, to your role in the movie Joshua Then and Now. And you starred along with James Woods in this movie. You played James Woods' father, a small-time Jewish gangster and bootlegger. And I want to play an excerpt from a flashback scene in which you're in a gym with your young son and you're teaching him about the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What do we got here? Quote, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," unquote. Yeah, you see, there was a lot of contenders in those days, other gods, mainly no account of idols, bums of the month, until our God, Jehovah, came in and took the title outright and made a covenant with our people.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's, thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal?
Yeah, right, well, you know, there's Ten Commandments. It's like an exam, right? I figure you get 8 out of 10 right. You're pretty much at the top of the class, aren't you?
Was there anyone you knew in life that you could pattern this character
on? Not a soul. No, nobody I knew. I loved that character. The minute I read the script, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with him. And that was it. I told Ted Kotcheff, the director, who was wonderful to work with, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, go ahead. That sounds good. And that's what I did. I worked out a lot. I got myself in pretty good shape for it, in scenes they never ended up using. So I got into good shape for nothing. For nothing.
What a waste of time.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I have read about you that in the late 60s or early 70s that you started yoga and also found someone who was something of a guru figure for you.
Mm-hmm.
What brought about that change?
What brought about the change was 7 years of analysis in which I worked very hard and which I feel like I really needed. I was very unhappy. And I came to a point where I was coming to the end of my analysis by both my doctor's recognition and my own and feeling like I'd passed the course and having him say akin to, "I never promised you a rose garden." And I found myself getting furious at that idea. Because I saw that there were people that had rose gardens, and I wanted one. And if analysis wasn't going to do it for me, particularly since I had worked very, very hard at it and had accomplished a lot of what my doctor felt was to be accomplished from it, I felt like I had to look elsewhere. And I started working with somebody who turned out, who I knew immediately was the best person I had ever met. He was the wisest and kindest person I'd ever met. And initially, I didn't know he was a yogi. He was my stand-in on a film, on Poppy. And
he was playing an extra?
He was my stand-in, which is not a terribly exalted job, as mm-hmm. everybody knows. And after about 3.5 weeks, I could sense very clearly that he was the center of the entire film. It's not as if he was loud or pushy or taking over anything, but he just radiated something that people gravitated towards. Like one person would be telling him their problems, another person would be asking him for a massage, and I got really quietly enraged by that. And it was again nothing that he was attempting to do. He wasn't attempting to run the show in any way. It was very quiet. And if you didn't really look for this, you wouldn't have even noticed it. And it annoyed me. So I said, here I am. I have everything. I'm the star. I got 10 times as much money as he's got. I got more attention. And he's the center of this thing. It's not right. So I tried to find out who and what he was, and he finally revealed the fact that he was a... Guru has got a terribly convoluted connotations this day. We've twisted around and almost destroyed the meaning of that word. Everybody who knows something is now called a guru, which is not what the word means by any stretch of the imagination. It means slayer of darkness, which is ultimately what analysis tries to do and doesn't do. It knocks off a piece of it, but it doesn't get the whole thing. And a great spiritual teacher knocks off your darkness, which is the thing that is keeping you from functioning fully and wholly and completely and lovingly.
Can I relate this back to acting and ask you if it's changed the way you act or changed how much you act or the kinds of roles you take?
Yeah, to a degree. It depends on how much money I've got in the bank, in part. I mean,
sure.
If I'm feeling pretty flush, then I feel more comfortable in turning down things that I don't want to do. But if I'm behind a payment on the house, then I got to be a little bit more generous in my assessment of something. But yeah, I don't want to play horrible people anymore. I don't want to. It's no fun. There was a time when I had so little sense of myself that getting out of my skin and being anybody else was a sigh of relief. But I kind of like myself now a lot of the times, and I don't see any real necessity or value in playing people that I find abhorrent anymore. That's number one. And number two, I like to think if I possibly can be in situations like it, I want my work to be connected with things that somehow serve people in some way.
Would you like to be working as much as possible or as little as possible?
I don't know. It depends on the project. I did a film in June that was a wonderful experience in every way. It's coming out in March. I'm starting another film next month, a Robert Redford film that we're doing in the West Indies. And that makes me very happy. I love working when it's with people that I'm excited about working with, and it's when it's with projects that are... have some redeeming feature about them. Otherwise, I'm just as happy to stay home and write or do nothing. I don't feel a burning need that I've got to act anymore or direct.
What do you do when you're doing nothing?
I'm thinking about writing when I'm doing nothing.
That's what a lot of writers do, is
yeah.
Think about writing.
Yeah, right.
Well, Alan Arkin, I thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
You're
wonderful to talk to.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed this very much.
You're very easy.
My guest has been Alan Arkin, and he's just directed a segment of the PBS comedy series Trying Times. It's called The Boss, and it stars Gene Stapleton and Corey Feldman, and you could see it in mid-November on public television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, dim sum and Peking duck with Chinese-American chef Ken Ham. He has a new book called Fragrant Harbor Taste, which is about the food of Hong Kong and how it's changed in the past few years. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Psychiatrist Irvin Yalom takes an approach with his patients that acknowledges our fears of death and the ultimate absurdity of life. Coming up, Yalom talks about existential psychotherapy. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker examines the similarities in new albums from two very different performers, Janet Jackson and Laurie Anderson. And guest film critic Peter Rayner reviews Drugstore Cowboy, starring Matt Dillon as a junkie who supports his habit by robbing drugstores and hospitals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In a protest against the bombing of a union hall this week, guerrillas in El Salvador withdrew from ceasefire talks with the rightist government. 10 people were killed in the bombing. The two sides in the decade-old civil war were scheduled to hold their third meeting this year, later on this month. Judges in Medellin, Colombia, have called a strike to protest the lack of government protection following the murder last night of a senior judge, the second to be gunned down in the city in the last 2 weeks. Simon Fisher in Bogota has more.
Superior Court Judge Mariela Espinosa Arango was shot by gunmen last night in Medellin, headquarters to Colombia's cocaine cartels. Just 2 weeks ago, another Superior Court judge was murdered, also by gunmen believed to be working on the cartel's orders. At that time, judges called a three-day strike to protest the failure of the government to provide promised protection, such as bulletproof jackets and armored vehicles. Judges claim that they have still not received adequate official protection and have now called an 8-day strike in protest. Judicial employees in Medellin have announced an indefinite strike until the killers are put on trial. Critics say that the authorities have lost control over the level of violence in the city, a center of operations for gangs of assassins for hire. Last weekend, there were 50 murders in less than 48 hours in Medellin. For National Public Radio, I'm Simon Fisher in Bogota.
The latest influx of would-be immigrants from East Germany is again causing problems for the West German embassy in Prague. As Ed Lucas, the BBC, reports, there is no sign of any long-term solution.
Diplomatic efforts are concentrated on two fronts, persuading the Czechoslovak authorities to provide alternative accommodation and trying to persuade East Germany to deal with the paperwork faster. At least one 80-seat bus is expected to leave for the West this evening, carrying those whose applications renouncing their citizenship have been handed in to the East German embassy here and then approved by the authorities in East Berlin. But neither buses to the West nor the diplomatic negotiations will solve the fundamental problem and may even worsen it. Now that the border with Czechoslovakia is open again, Prague offers a tempting escape hatch for more East Germans, like those already in the embassy, who don't believe the reform process at home will deliver the freedom and prosperity they want.
Ed Lucas, the BBC, reporting from Prague. In a series of top-level changes in East German government, the wife of ousted Communist Party leader Erich Honecker lost her job today. Meanwhile, new party leader Egon Krenz says his government wants closer ties with the European Economic Community, and he called for a speedy trade agreement. On a one-day trip to Warsaw, Krenz also talked about reforms with Poland's new prime minister. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 14 points to close at 2,631.56 on volume of some 152,440,000 shares. Trading was moderate as declines led advances 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Last week, our rock critic Ken Tucker did a review of new albums by Linda Ronstadt and Kate Bush, two performers with very different pop styles. This week, his review creates another odd couple, the pop chart queen Janet Jackson and the doyen of performance art Laurie Anderson.
Well, I stopped in at the body shop. Said to the guy, I want stereo FM installed in my teeth. Then take this mole off my back and put it on my cheek. And while I'm here, why don't you give me some of those high-heeled feet? And he said, listen, there's no guarantee. Nature's got rules and nature's got laws. But listen, the guy with the monkey's paw. And I said, what?
By any conventional pop culture standard, Laurie Anderson and Janet Jackson do not belong in the same review. We're conditioned to think of pop performers in terms of genre and image, and in these areas, Anderson and Jackson are mutually exclusive. But I think that their new albums have much in common. Common themes, common ambitions, common pretensions, common technology. There's a sense in which Janet Jackson's new album, Rhythm Nation 1814, is as much a piece of performance art as anything Laurie Anderson has done. It's organized around an idea. Jackson has said that her previous album, the huge hit Control, was about her own life, her struggle for control within the confines of the famous Jackson family. This new album, she says, is about what's going on in the world around her, and she's written songs about such topics as drugs, illiteracy, and on the title song, racism. On that song, Janet Jackson takes an old Sly and the Family Stone riff and subjects it to up-to-the-minute synthesizer technology and comes up with a tough piece of music. Laurie Anderson does much the same thing on Strange Angels. The album collects new songs and a few compositions from Anderson's lengthy new stage piece, Empty Spaces, but I find that it holds up very well on its own as a unified album about the seductive nature of control in art, in marriage, in family relationships, in politics.
Say women shouldn't be the president, 'cause they go crazy from time to time. Well, push my button, baby, here I come. Yeah, look out, I'm in hot time. Beautiful red dress, you look free.
That's Beautiful Red Dress, a song about sexual power that, like all of Anderson's best work, is most spectacular when it's most offhand and low-key. Anderson emerged a decade ago from the New York downtown avant-garde and has attracted a much bigger audience than anyone could have expected, at least in part, because her warm voice shares intimate, if fictional, confessions. Janet Jackson emerged from the shadow of her brother Michael and has attracted a much bigger audience than anyone could have expected, at least in part, because her music, which is a collaboration with producers Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, is an exciting compression of hard beats and terse melodies. For both Janet Jackson and Laurie Anderson, the visual is as important as the musical. Their images help define their work. Laurie Anderson's stage presentations offer her as a figure in isolation, often shrouded in darkness. There's a surrealism to the looming symbols she projects on a screen behind her, as well as in the way she frequently distorts her voice electronically. By contrast, in Janet Jackson's tightly choreographed music videos, she and a group of dancers make all the same curt, rigid moves at the same time. Dressed in vaguely military garb, Jackson is creating fascistic funk. As different as they are, both Jackson and Anderson are sending out messages about strong female images that a lot of people are responding to.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's some more from Laurie Anderson from Strange Angels.
If I were the president, if I were queen for a day,
This is Fresh Air. While Irvin Yalom was studying to be a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University, he grew dissatisfied with Freudian and other traditional methods of psychoanalysis. Around this time, he discovered the works of Rollo May and was introduced to a new way of looking at human problems. He likened May's approach to the fiction of Dostoevsky, Kafka, and Tolstoy. Yalom always felt that these writers revealed more about the human condition than psychological theorists did. Yalom now practices what he describes as existential psychotherapy, helping his patients cope with the pain of existence. His new book, Love's Executioner, describes his approach by presenting case histories of 10 patients.
Existential psychotherapy is not a separate school, ideological school of psychotherapy. I mean, people can't, as they often call me, find an existential psychotherapist in practice or an institute, but it's an accent in therapy. And by that I mean it's a therapist who looks at accents certain basic dimensions in human existence, which are that I think that there are certain human certain givens of human existence that are a tremendous source of concern and anxiety for us all. These givens of existence, which I think of as death and freedom and isolation and the issue of meaning in life, frequently playing a role in our internal psychological economy. So that an existential psychotherapist is a therapist who takes these things into consideration in working with his patients. Not all patients, but whenever it seems appropriate. These are not things that one looks the other way about.
So in other words, not every problem is going to relate to some kind of turning point in somebody's life or to the way their parents brought them up. It might have to do with just their unwillingness to face death or the difficulty of realizing that they are alone.
That's right. There are frequently issues that come up in therapy that may relate to some of these basic fears. I mean, for example, looking at nightmares. Nightmares are very often just an example of kind of naked death anxiety that's exploded into consciousness, and that the nightmare really won't be fully understood until you really are willing to grapple with the patient's fear of dying.
If you're dealing with someone who clearly has a lot of anxiety about the ultimate aloneness of each human being, you know, even if they're not putting it that way, what does your job become to, like, commiserate with them, to make them feel less alone, or to make them more aware of the fact that sense of aloneness is the problem?
Well, I think probably all those, but in addition to that, sometimes the most important work occurs in terms of perhaps some misguided, maybe desperate efforts on their part to provide themselves some sort of shield against isolation, so that many people may relate to another person, not because of any caring about that person, but just simply to use that person as a shield against this type of isolation. It's tremendous fear of being alone, tremendous fear of spending any time alone, and that sometimes it's useful to take a look at what they're doing with other people, how they're misusing other people, and then take a look at what the fear is really about being alone. What does it mean? Why are some people so threatened by it?
I want to ask you about a case study in your book that you call The Fat Lady, and this is about a woman who you've given the pseudonym of Betty to. She
Yes.
was 250 pounds. She was a working woman in her 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And you admit that you've always been repelled by fat women and that you find them disgusting. Did you feel that you could work with an obese woman feeling that way?
Well, I started off this case and this story having a lot of doubts about that, because I always have felt and feel very strongly that the basis of the psychotherapeutic enterprise is the relationship, is beginning to form a genuine, authentic relationship with the other person. And if I have these strong negative feelings about the way that a person looks, then I had really to question whether or not I could relate to this person. And I also felt that when I started seeing her, that it was time for me to do something about these particular kinds of attitudes in myself.
Let me ask you, are you repelled by fat men also, or is it just women?
Well, naturally, I'm highlighting and exaggerating a little bit in the story to increase the dramatic effect of the story, but I have some of the same sort of ungainly feelings about extremely fat men at all. At least I did in the past. The story is a story of some change on my part, so a story of some dual transformation.
She ended up losing about 100 pounds while in therapy with you. And also understanding a lot more about herself and feeling better about herself. What do you think was the turning point in the therapeutic relationship?
I think the turning point was when I began to shift and when I began to really acknowledge that she and I were not having a real relationship, so that as I could be much more honest with her and really help her do away with some of the obstacles that were being placed between us. I mean, for example, one of the first things that happened as we began to work is that I was aware that I was finding her exceedingly boring, so that I almost found myself falling asleep when I was meeting with her. And after a while, it became clear to me that if someone is boring, that's a very important piece of data, that we need to use that. And because that one of the axioms in psychotherapy is that if you feel this way towards the patient, the chances are that other people in their environment at large will feel this way too. So that I began to then consider the issue of boredom as a piece of data. And then I began to embark on the sort of exploratory venture. Well, how come she's boring? What does she do that's so boring? What can we do to change that? And with her, it had to do with sort of having an as-if personality, that what she felt she had to do was to entertain me, because at bottom she was fairly empty and had nothing of substance to offer. So she had to play games, tell jokes, be the stereotypic jolly fat person as a way of entertaining me. And as I began to challenge that and actually got her permission to call her on that, let her know when I saw her doing that, then we got to other things that were deeper. And when we began to do that, when a person begins to reveal their true self and begins to do so in ways that are what should we say, unpredictable and unexpected, well, then everyone becomes very interesting.
Do you often point out to your patients things that they're doing in their interactions with you, assuming that this is also the kind of thing they do interacting with other people?
Oh, right. It's an absolute central feature of my psychotherapy with individuals. Look very much at what's happening in the immediate here and now of therapy.
Are there any risks for you involved with that? Does a patient ever look at you and say, yeah, well, doctor, look at what you're doing in your relationship with me?
Well, I'd absolutely welcome that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's absolutely fair game. And then I've got to look at that. And I've got to take my responsibility for what I'm doing. And if the patient is indeed pointing out some blind spot of something I'm doing, then I have got to take it very seriously.
In your book, you write that you gave up on the idea that the therapist succeeds when they find that turning point in which a life went astray. That reminds me of, in certain movies, the therapist gets the patient to realize one crucial incident in their childhood, and suddenly the patient is cured. Suddenly they transform; they're a new person.
I sure wish it happened. You know, I've been in the practice for a long time, and I have never seen a patient significantly helped in that way. It would be wonderful if it would occur, you know. But I do believe that the whole trend in psychotherapy, and it was really Freud's trend, he always felt that the deepest way of understanding a problem was to find the earliest representative of that problem. But I think that was a bum steer in psychotherapy, and always has been, and that you can rummage around in the past for years with patients without it being significantly helpful.
Well, if that kind of revelation about a turning point from the past doesn't bring permanent change in a patient's life, what does?
Well, I think what brings permanent change is the patient learning more about the way that they're living in the world right now, learning about how they're avoiding living, learning that some of the fears they have of being close to people or of conducting their life in such a way are to be disconfirmed, that they can begin to do these things and these calamitous things that would happen to them, in fact, do not happen. I think the turning point for many is forming a very significant deep relationship with another human being. Now, sometimes spending a lot of time working in the past, as many therapists do, in a sense, helps that process occur, because spending a long time studying the past in minute detail is a very engrossing exercise for both patients and therapists. It keeps both their interest very high, while during this time, you know, the real therapeutic tool, which is the therapeutic relationship, is really ripening on the vine.
So you think the therapeutic relationship itself is the key, not necessarily the revelations about the past?
I do think that, and there certainly is a very persuasive body of evidence, you know, in psychotherapy research to really underscore that, to make that point.
Your new book is a collection of case studies. What do you think the value of case studies are, especially when they're slightly fictionalized, as yours are?
I think it gives a pretty close look at what can happen in psychotherapy, what I think should happen in psychotherapy. There are some of the existential points that I want to make that I think are best made in a type of with a type of literary conveyance. So the stories are tales of psychotherapy, which are teaching tales, and they're meant to be teaching tales. I'm teaching a course at Stanford now where we're considering them one by one.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. You're very welcome. Pleased to be here.
Dr. Irvin Yalom is the author of Love's Executioner and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. It's published by Basic Books. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Lots of things, including a discussion of the difficulties now faced by East Germany's new leader, Egon Krenz, as East Germans continue to leave his country by the thousands. Also, the story of thousands of children who were taken from the streets of New York City early in the century, poor children, most of them orphans, and sent on orphan trains out west for adoption. We'll talk with a woman in Bismarck, North Dakota, who grew up there and only found out later in life that she indeed was an orphan from New York. And we'll talk with and hear some music from singer and songwriter Sean Colvin. She talks about the production that went into her brand new album for Columbia Records.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Drugstore Cowboy is a new movie about drug abuse from a junkie's perspective. Matt Dillon stars. Guest film critic Peter Rayner has a review.
Drugs and drug dealing are so much a part of movies and television shows and the nightly news that it's no wonder many of us feel overdosed on the subject. But it would be a crime if movie audiences passed up Drugstore Cowboy. It's one of the few films about drug addicts that's expressive rather than exploitive. The film is based on an unpublished novel by a convict junkie, and appears to have been made from deep inside an addict's consciousness. Everything about it is dislocated, dreamy, and agitated. The movie is set in 1971 and is about two couples who support their habits by robbing pharmacies and hospitals throughout the Pacific Northwest. Matt Dillon's Bob is the slack-jawed leader of this gang of ragamuffin dopers. They also include Bob's girlfriend Diane, played by the gifted Kelly Lynch, Bob's buddy Rick, played by James LeGros, and Rick's companion Nadine, portrayed by Heather Graham, who bears a striking resemblance to a Barbie doll Bardot. It doesn't take much to be the leader of this pack. Bob wins out through the sheer force of his lunatic savvy. He may be perpetually groggy from the residue of 1,000 fixes, but when he's pulling off a robbery, he's surprisingly agile and quick-witted. He also has as many superstitions as a professional gambler, which, in a sense, is what he is. Finally, he tells Diane the gamble isn't worth it anymore.
Thinking about heading back home, getting on the 21-day methadone program, cleaning up my hands.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not. Diane, I can't do it anymore.
Well, I'm not going on no withdrawal program. So what's gonna happen to me?
Why don't you come with me?
No thanks, Buster. Right out of the clear blue sky, you say you're gonna clean up your hand. And you know I can't.
Drugstore Cowboy deals with sordid lives, but it does so in a way that doesn't drag you down. It's reminiscent of other movies about fixated outlaws, ranging from Bonnie and Clyde to Sid and Nancy, but it has its own distinctive, funky lyricism. The director, Gus Van Sant, whose only previous feature was shot in 16mm for $25,000, has a great eye for the total climate of addiction. His cast, which also includes novelist William Burroughs and a cameo as a junkie priest, has the soulful, famished look of the undead. The suburban landscapes are hallucinatory, higgledy-piggledy panoramas like some deranged overview of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. The crime sprees in this film are not romanticized. The participants aren't acting out some director's fancy sociological scenario about the haves and the have-nots. Bob and his gang don't want to get rich, they just want to get high. And stay high. As Drugstore Cowboy shows us, the dirty business of staying high and staying straight is pretty tough work indeed, and it gives those of us who aren't junkies a bird's-eye view of the lower depths.
Peter Rayner is or was film critic for the late Los Angeles Herald Examiner. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Audrey Vablaitis, Bob Alls, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ken Hom compares America's Chinese restaurants with the restaurants of Hong Kong. And trumpeter Lester Bowie tells us how years on the road with rhythm and blues bands influenced his playing in the jazz groups, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and Brass Fantasy. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.